Welcome to the 9th episode of the Berkeley Institute Live podcast. Today's episode features Stephanie Rotem and Rebecca Goldberg. In recognition of Holocaust Remembrance Day, this program will feature a conversation on Holocaust museums and memory. In light of the current COVID-19 crisis around the world, we'll also discuss the ways to commemorate without access to physical space or communities, and the shifting role of museums in this national moment. This episode is part of the Berkeley Institute for Jewish Law and Israel Studies Live podcast series. Episodes every Tuesdays and Thursdays engage students and faculty on timely topics related to Israel and Jewish law, thought, and identity. Each episode is aired live and consists of 30 minutes of interview, followed by an interactive Q&A. And past episodes can be found on our website. So today we're very lucky to have Stephanie Rotem here. Stephanie has been a teaching fellow at Tel Aviv University since 2013. She was teaching in the interdisciplinary program in the arts. She served both as the head of the diploma program and faculty of the arts. Rotem received her master's in 2005 and her PhD in 2010, both from the interdisciplinary program in the arts at Tel Aviv University. Rotem is also an architect and a graduate of Technion Israel Institute of Technology, and she practiced architecture for 10 years before returning to graduate school to pursue her academic research. And this year, Stephanie is a visiting professor with the Berkeley Institute for Jewish Law and Israel Studies and has been teaching courses on the architectural history of Tel Aviv, Holocaust museums in Israel and in the world, as well as on Israeli art and culture. And Stephanie will be in conversation with Rebecca Goldberg, who is the executive director of the Berkeley Institute for Jewish Law and Israel Studies. She received her doctorate in social anthropology from the University of Oxford under the supervision of Jonathan Weber. She earned her BA in anthropology from Princeton University and a Master of Dispute Resolution from Strauss Institute for Dispute Resolution at Pepperdine University School of Law. Her work focuses on Jewish and Holocaust studies, anthropology and ethnography, and conflict resolution and mediation. Her doctoral and postdoctoral research focuses on Ukrainian Jewish communities and identity, as well as on Holocaust memory and memorialization within post-Soviet Ukraine. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Rebecca to start us off. And thanks for joining.
Great. Can you all hear me? Great. Thank you, Maya. And I want to also just add a warm welcome to everybody who's here. I'm sort of grinning, seeing all of the faces. I'm really appreciative. So Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
I want to start by asking you about your teaching. You've been here all year, and now you've shifted and are teaching remotely through this quarantine or sheltering in place, including a course on Holocaust museums in Israel and around the world. Could you tell us a little bit about that, how your approach has shifted in the virtual context, and how you're engaging differently with your students?
Sure. So hi, everyone. So I have some of my students here, too, so they could maybe later on add some of their own thoughts on this. But it has been a little bit of an adjustment. So I'm kind of a teacher that likes to be close to my students, and I really feed off of their facial expressions and their eyes as we go through our lessons and trying to see how they follow. And also just it's been a little bit of a challenge with the technology. So we've had a little bit of a role reversal where my students would say, hey, you need to press that, you know, little button on the right and do this and that. And they've been my teachers a little bit in the beginning. I'm getting the hang of it now. And I think just one kind of interesting answer that I've realized that students, because they're so comfortable with technology, actually, there are some students that I feel participate in class like more than they would maybe in a regular standard classroom, maybe feeling more comfortable in their own bedrooms talking. They will ask questions that maybe they wouldn't have in class. But yeah, I'm looking forward to going back to regular teaching.
Right. Can you give us a brief history of Holocaust museums and how they got started, when they began to emerge, how many there are? I know that's certainly a part of what you're addressing in your classroom.
Yeah. So I've been doing research on Holocaust museums now for 15 years. That was the subject of my PhD dissertation and later a book that I published. So I'll give just a short survey. I think that will help us kind of get into the subject. So the first Holocaust museum ever was built on Kibbutz Lochmei HaGetaot in 1950, very early on. And Yad Vashem followed, but it wasn't a museum at first. So in 1953 in Israel, they passed what is called the Yad Vashem law, which one part of that law is the creation of a campus that would include a research institute, but also a museum. The first building on the Yad Vashem campus was actually only built in 1956, but it was only an administration building. And the first exhibition that they had was just like in the passageway, in the halls of the administration building. And the actual first Holocaust exhibition for the public was built in 1973. Mm-hmm. And it was in the basement of Oel Yizkor, which is the memorial hall. So actually until the creation, the inauguration of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., the component of the museum at Yad Vashem was a minor component of the campus. People would come more to Yad Vashem in order to go to Oel Yizkor, to look at the eternal light, and then to look at the different monuments and memorials on the campus. The museum was just a very small part of that whole kind of ritual of visiting Yad Vashem. Mm-hmm. So the big difference in Holocaust museums comes with the inauguration of the museum in Washington, D.C. First thoughts of that museum were as early as 1978. And this was actually initiated by President Carter, who had been at that time in a little bit odds with the Jewish community, the American Jewish community, over the sales deal of ammunition to Syria, which was against Israelis' wishes. And in order to kind of compensate for that, he turned to his advisor for Jewish affairs and asked him what he could do to get Jewish support, and was instructed to create a Holocaust, to allow the Jewish community to create a Holocaust memorial. So he appointed what he called a commission, a President's Commission of the Holocaust. And this was in 1978, and it was announced at a very celebratory ball to celebrate 30 years for the independence of the State of Israel. Mm-hmm. And he put Eli Wiesel at the head of this committee, and that was his big mistake, because he wasn't going to settle for a memorial. And after months of deliberating with different intellectuals and historians and people from the Jewish community, they came up with a proposition which included three components, with one of them what they called a living memorial, which would be actually a museum. And it took them almost 15 years to build the museum. So the museum was actually inaugurated in 1993. And the success was so tremendous that this was a catalyzer for many other museums. So almost right away in 1997, the Museum of Jewish Heritage, which is called Museum of Jewish Heritage, a living memorial to the Holocaust. Not a lot of people know that there's the second part of the name of the museum in 1997. I forgot to mention that the Museum of Tolerance, which also in Los Angeles, was also has a second part of its name, which is Beit HaShoah, opened in the same year as the museum in Washington, D.C. in 1993. And the Holocaust Museum in Houston opened in 1997. Mm-hmm. So this was a beginning of this proliferation of Holocaust museums. And today you can count anywhere between 15 and 20 museums per se. And when I say museums, I mean actual museums that have their own buildings with all a collection, All the services that we expect from a museum, because if we want to count every kind of small exhibition that might be in a Jewish community center or a college, or we can get to dozens of those. So actual museums, about 15 to 20. And it's interesting that there are still museums under construction today. So the one that I'm aware of is quite a large museum being built in Chandler, Arizona. Of all places. Yeah. So, and this is, of course, also there are dozens of memorials and educational centers that don't even call themselves museums.
So let me ask you here, you've brought up a bunch of issues about that touch into the question of what the essential mission of a Holocaust museum is or should be, and also pieces of how a museum gets created, how it gets designed, and what the role of different things are that are involved, whether that be the art and architecture, or also aspects of material culture, the narratives, the oral and archival history, all of those pieces that go into a successful Holocaust museum, and some of the examples that you've given. Could you talk a little bit about what you see as the most important roles of a Holocaust museum and what pieces go into constructing and designing it?
Okay, so generally I can say that most Holocaust museums will define their mission in two, they have two missions. So the first, the obvious mission would be to commemorate the victims. So even that becomes not an easy mission, because you have to define who those victims are, if we're talking about just Jewish victims, if we're talking about Jewish victims and other groups, ethnic groups, or political prisoners, or whoever else was victimized by the Nazis. Mm-hmm. So that's one mission. And the other is what they call teaching the lessons of the Holocaust, which is a very bewildering kind of term, because what are the lessons of the Holocaust, and how do you teach those? And that is probably the core of a Holocaust museum and the core challenge for a Holocaust museum. And everything that we can talk about, whether it's the art, the architectures, the curatorship of the exhibitions, all go into that. What do we actually want to say in the museum? What is the story that we're going to tell in the museum? And what do we want our visitors to leave with? When they finish walking through the exhibition, what do they take with them? So the events of the Holocaust are just so vast, and there are so complex that it's obvious that they can't all be contained in one museum. There is, even though Yad Vashem thinks that that's what they try to do, even Yad Vashem can't have in their at least four hour long exhibition every single event that's relevant to learning and about the Holocaust. So this is where the museum's curators come in, the historians and curators. And once their first job is to select, right, what are the events that are in communities that will be commemorated inside of the museum. And every selection that they make, everything that is selected to be shown, is also one event that won't be shown and will be forgotten. So they are constantly negotiating what is remembered and what is forgotten in a Holocaust museum. Mm-hmm. And everything that they do, which is the art and the architecture, the exhibition design of the museum, can support that decision. So if where the objects are placed, the documents are placed, which ones are highlighted, even what light is poured on each, the actual light poured on the exhibition, where the texture of the floor serves to slow down visitors or speed them up, and then how long will we stand in front of a particular exhibition? How is it easy to read the text, or is it difficult to read the text? How long are we gonna spend time on it? So all of these decisions are very political decisions, in the sense that they decide for our collective memory, what will be remembered from the Holocaust and what won't.
Mm-hmm. Relating to that, where do you see museums fitting in that continuum between history and memory, in terms of how much they're informed by history, by historians and historiography, and how much they see themselves more as in the role of shaping collective memory?
I think Holocaust museums are completely political institutions. That has been almost the most important conclusion from my research, is that even though at a certain, in a way, there's been like this international or narrative that's being told, a universal narrative that you'll find in almost every museum. Mm-hmm. But I find that the supporting, like the exhibition design, the architecture, and the art inside the museum are the ones that steer that narrative in different directions. Mm-hmm. And I can give examples, for example, one way that I kind of looked at those is how exhibitions end. So what is the last object that you see in the museum? So when you are in the museum in New York and you finish the exhibition, the first thing that you see is the Statue of Liberty from the window of the museum. And obviously that concludes the narrative with this optimistic tone of coming to America and living in a democracy. In Yad Vashem, you exit to the balcony and that looks over the Jerusalem hills, and this is a completely different narrative, a Zionist narrative. Mm-hmm. And you can see in different museums in the world what they point at the last exhibition. So these were like points that I looked at to and saw how they shape the way we remember what we see.
It's really interesting. Tell us more about that physical space of the museum. Museums are generally thought to be spaces that are physically, intellectually, and emotionally experienced. And obviously now we're in a moment where we can't go to the museum. So maybe we can you can talk a little bit about how the museum works as a physical space, and then we can segue into talking about this current moment of quarantine where we have to experience the museum differently.
Right. So the most important feature, or the thing that actually distinguishes museums or learning in a museum from other means of learning, other media, is that it has that physical space. So when people come to a museum, there's two aspects of that. The first aspect is that they're gathering within a space, which is almost a ritual, a social ritual. So I always notice people, how they react when they walk into museums. And I won't forget that once I went to an art museum, I think it was in Chicago, and two women had met at the museum, and they went to the souvenir shop and they went to the cafeteria, and then when they came out and they said, well, we had a great experience in the museum. I don't think they visited any of the exhibitions. So museums are also just a social ritual that Western culture in particular partakes in. So there's that aspect of it. And so the physicality is important. Just to come to the museum makes us feel differently. We are more open to experiences. But I think the more important aspect for that is that the physical structure gives the museum authority. We know that it costs a lot of money to build. Someone had to approve the building. There were a lot of professional aspects that were poured into it. So it's almost like a gateway to that the authority of knowledge. We don't question the authority or the narrative that's written within the museum, because we think that the fact that there's this big building that's cost so much money to build makes what we see true. So that allows people to be more open to what is taught inside a museum. And a third aspect of that, which is very relevant to Holocaust museums is that the museum holds artifacts which we can see with our eyes and are authentic artifacts. And these serve as a form of evidence for the Holocaust, because we don't come to a Holocaust museum to see beautiful objects. We come to learn history, and the objects, the artifacts in there both illustrate that history, but also give evidence of it. So those three aspects together make the physical presence of the museum very important to its authority.
So in this current moment where we've shifted to sheltering, what is it like to experience the Holocaust Museum? How are museums adapting? Mm-hmm. And what are they able to do in this current quarantine moment? And what are they not able to do or convey?
So I've been thinking a lot about that, because obviously one of the things that we experience in every field, not just in museums, is the new use of technology. Everyone has to use technology now in order to be able to communicate with each other. And it seems that there it might be even this enthusiasm for using technology. And I try to think of what that might mean. So I want to backtrack a little bit and say that Holocaust museums have always used a lot of technology, maybe more than other museums, and probably because the fact that the artifacts themselves are not, you know, so visually aesthetic, and they were always seeking for means to engage people in the exhibitions. Mm-hmm. So at first, the technology was used just inside the museum, okay? So you could, inside the museum, see maybe more, in the beginning, more video testimonies than you had seen in other kinds of museums. When internet became used by everyone, then the technology was used for their websites, which was more, again, information about the museum, about the exhibitions. And even if they would send you out like to see another website, it was still linked to the museum exhibition itself. Mm-hmm. In recent years, and I'm sure a lot of you have seen the part on 60 Minutes, I think a couple weeks ago, about the use of holograms, 3D holograms of Holocaust survivors in museums, which has been another use of technology. In Los Angeles, they have a figure of a Holocaust survivor explaining a model of Treblinka, which in the past had been like the task of a Holocaust survivor. And so they're trying to maybe replace their voices with some kind of technology. But all of these things are still completely connected to the museum, to the physical space. So recently I just saw that Auschwitz has a Twitter account. And what they do is hashtag Auschwitz. Every day you can get a picture of a Holocaust survivor on their, a Holocaust victim on their birthday. And this is still connected to the exhibition, but once Auschwitz realized that they're getting so much, so many people are going into their Twitter account, they decided to use that in other ways. And they, for example, have used that to warn Amazon of selling anti-Semitic objects on their website. They had, for example, Christmas lights with pictures of concentration camps on them. So they've notified. So obviously, that's something that we would encourage, but we have to realize this is not connected to the museum anymore. Mm-hmm. So what happens when we don't have the physical space and the museums begin to use technology that is not connected to that space? So how will they continue to be the authoritative voice of what is proper or what is true historical events? How will the public be able to even distinguish between what are the real and the fake sources, right, in this time of fake news, right? And also, how will we be able to use these artifacts, these evidence, how will they be experienced by the public? Because through a screen, we know that Photoshop can do anything, right? So mm-hmm. So I on the one hand, it's using technology expands their influence, and they can address audiences that might not have the ability to access the museum. But on the other hand, they lose so much of their inherent qualities that I worry, and I really don't know what will happen with technology.
So they kind of lose their source of authority when they explore the virtual world and it's too disconnected from their...
I think that's happening. So yeah, if I connect it to the positive aspects of that, so we can look at Yom HaShoah, for example. So using technology to have Yom HaShoah ceremonies has been enabled now by all museums, small museums. It doesn't matter what your collection is, or how many people visit that museum, or how prominent it is, and how much funds it is. Anyone can have a Zoom ceremony, right? Because it doesn't entail all the logistics of the other museum or the memorials, which is a good thing, because it allows us to bring in maybe stories that are not usually heard, more personal stories, something more communal.
I do want to ask you that. Just to frame it, today is Yom HaShoah, or Holocaust Remembrance Day, and there have been a host of virtual ceremonies. And I wonder, maybe stepping back for a moment, to talk about how this day is normally commemorated and how it might look a little bit differently today.
Yeah, so in Israel, it's normally commemorated by official ceremonies. So there's one at Yad Vashem and there's one at the Ghetto Fighters House. Those are the two main ceremonies in Israel. Mm-hmm. But and they're televised, and so you could say that that's almost the same as having a Zoom ceremony. But of course it's not, because in order for it to be televised, it has to be important enough a museum to have the television crew come there. They have to have the proper setting. They have to have the audience, because or else they don't televise it. And here you can have every single exhibition, memorial, education center can have, school can have their own ceremony. And then does that make the more official ceremonies redundant, and then we maybe lose that collective sense of those official ceremonies? So I don't have a great affinity for ceremonies, but maybe they're important for our collectivity or collective memory. And we might lose that once we all just stare into our little computers and memorialize in that way.
Mm-hmm. Going back to the conversation about Holocaust museums, do you think that this current moment of sheltering and looking at museums virtually will have a more permanent impact on Holocaust museums, as well as commemorations, on their designs, on their modes of engagement, their use of technology? Like, how should museums be thinking about their future? And what are some of the risks that come with this shift in focus and this enhanced use of technology?
Yeah, okay, so I think that, the main issue now in these times for Holocaust museums is what we would call like maybe a comparison, or do we actually teach or commemorate universal messages or particular ones or Jewish ones? Okay, so and whenever I think about that, I always bring up this quote by Primo Levi, who wrote in The Drowned and the Saved. He wrote, "As if the hunger in Auschwitz were the same as that of someone who has skipped a meal." And when the museums try to, or in general, when we try to make these comparisons, I always remember that quote, because obviously we can't compare. On the other hand, if we don't compare, then how are our museums going to be relevant to the public? So maybe they might always be relevant to Jewish people as part of their history, but why do we think they're relevant enough to have a national museum in Washington if it's not relevant to the general public? So in order to make it relevant, in order to make it something that we can think about, to give it some kind of meaning, obviously we can't stay in Auschwitz. We have to bring it more into our lives. But the question is how we find that balance so that it's not diminished and not brought in a way that is completely, feels like it's completely detached from the, and I can give you examples. There are have been so in one way it's just even the use of the word Holocaust in many times, like Holocaust of animals when you're talking about butchering, but the Los Angeles Museum, for example, the not the Museum of Tolerance, but the Los Angeles Museum of the Holocaust, has it's built underground, and its rooftop is grass, and it got all of these awards as being a green building. Mm-hmm. And they wrote in their about the museum, they write that this is a lesson of the Holocaust because they are saving the planet. So I think we always need to ask, is everything that makes us a better person or makes it a better world a lesson of the Holocaust? How far do we stretch, and how do we find that balance? So the museum in Belgium, the Holocaust Museum in Belgium, has an introductory film that begins with a group of children bullying an overweight child on the playground. And then from there they go on to acts of prejudice, and from there they go into persecution and then into genocide. So maybe that's a little bit of a jump to go from playground bullying to the Holocaust. So I feel like that has been the big challenge, and you can see how that challenge is coming into museums. So I think the first big debate about that had been with the creation of the Holocaust. Well, it ended up not being a Holocaust, but what was supposed to be a Holocaust museum in Ottawa, Canada, where when they began to plan the museum, many communities in the area said, well, you know, the Jews weren't the only victims of the Holocaust, and they demanded to be included. But it actually became such an issue that the Museum of Holocaust became the Museum of Human Rights, with five different sections in it, and one of them is about the Holocaust. Mm. And we've seen now the museum in Houston added a new annex to the building, and it's about human rights. Mm-hmm. And I personally think that in the next few years, all the Holocaust museums are gonna transform their exhibitions. And I don't think that we'll have Holocaust museums anymore. I think we'll have these, they might still call them that, but I think a Holocaust is going to become a case study, maybe the extreme case study, but that's what it'll be for human rights and humanitarian. So I'll give you another example, which is, I think, is even more alarming. So I think in 2015, there was a ceremony in Sweden, I don't remember in which town, for Kristallnacht. And they did not invite any representatives from the Jewish community. And when they were reprimanded about it, they explained that the Jewish voice confuses the issues.
Right.
So I'll leave it at that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.